This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Emergency services in Western Australia are facing widespread power and telecommunications outages as they begin to assess the damage caused by ex-tropical cyclone Seroja, which has devastated small coastal and farming communities in the state's midwest. Major infrastructure has been affected and evacuation centres set up for residents who've had roofs ripped off their homes, while those with properties still standing aren't likely to have power for several days, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
When the storm cleared, the residents of the small holiday town of Kalbarri were out assessing the carnage left in its wake.
The whole house has been destroyed, inside, outside. There's no roofs left, there's nothing left. Gone. Yeah.
Emotionally.
I'm just broken. Seriously broken.
I've been in a couple of cyclones before, but nothing like that.
The towns of Kalbarri, which is close to 700 k's north of Perth and Northampton, were the hardest hit by Cyclone Seroja. Many smaller surrounding communities sustained extensive damage too. Department of Fire and Emergency Services Commissioner Darren Clem says power and telecommunications outages are causing significant challenges.
The reality is that the power is going to be off for days rather than hours, and there's a significant job of work ahead for Western Power to reinstate that.
It's horrible, and I'm constantly checking my phone. My phone keeps on dying because I'm using so much battery, checking Facebook.
Cindy Cannon and her family evacuated from Kalbarri on the weekend before the cyclone hit. She woke up to messages from her neighbour, Jenny, which is how she learned her house had been destroyed. But power outages mean she hasn't been able to reach anyone in town since early yesterday.
I have no roof. I have no roof struts anymore. The left-hand side of the front face of my house is ripped off. My roof has taken out my brand new front gate and fence, as well as Jenny's front yard, and is currently sitting in between both of our houses at the end of our cul-de-sac.
What do you think would have happened if you guys had stayed in that house?
Those top three front windows that you can see in the photo of my house, that's mine and my children's bedrooms, and the roof is ripped off above them and the walls ripped off. So I know if we had have stayed and I had have slept through it, my children would have been ripped from their beds. It's absolutely gut-wrenching to think that I nearly stayed.
Buildings in these towns weren't constructed to withstand such severe winds, and it's rare for a cyclone to make landfall this far south along the WA coast. Cindy Cannon's main concern now is how her neighbour is holding up.
I feel also like I've let them down, like leaving and not being able there to help them. The silence it's daunting, it's horrible.
Defence personnel and emergency volunteers from interstate will help with the clean-up, and there'll be joint federal and state disaster relief payments.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. Years of talk so far have failed to sort it, yet the federal government's declaring it wants to hold a workshop to help end a long-running trans-Tasman trademark battle over a lucrative type of honey. Manuka honey, which many claim has significant health benefits, is produced by bees that collect nectar from a native tree found in both Australia and New Zealand. Yet the Kiwis want exclusive rights to the word Manuka. From Canberra, here's political reporter James Glendale.
Well, I've been using Manuka honey for years.
Kourtney Kardashian is just one of the many LA-based celebrities who believe in the benefits of Manuka honey.
I love like as much natural stuff as I can get.
The product's been promoted by the likes of actress Gwyneth Paltrow and tennis star Novak Djokovic, and in recent years, its price has soared. The honey is produced by bees from nectar from trees found in New Zealand and Australia. But here, local beekeepers say their Kiwi counterparts are threatening their livelihoods.
It'd be absolutely devastating. It would devastate a lot of people's businesses and the industry here.
Paul Callender from the Australian Manuka Honey Association says the problem is some New Zealand producers are determined to trademark the word Manuka. The Kiwis argue it has Maori origins and should be exclusively reserved for New Zealand honey in the same way the French use the term champagne, though the Australians disagree.
We have no problems with the New Zealanders using the word Manuka with a macron over the A or a double A. which is the correct spelling and has a meaning in New Zealand, that's absolutely understood. But the way we spell it as Manuka doesn't have any of those. And so we simply want to be able to use our own spelling of our own word to trade as we should be able to trade.
The debate has raged for years. A court decision is due within months, and now the Australian government is getting involved. The Trade Minister, Dan Tehan, raised the matter with his New Zealand counterpart yesterday, calling for a unified trans-Tasman push to market the product. In a statement to the ABC, he said,
I propose that the Australian and New Zealand governments jointly facilitate a workshop with our respective Manuka honey industries, including in areas such as industry development, research, joint marketing, technology sharing, and addressing fraudulent honey products.
Australian beekeepers have welcomed his intervention, though they're not convinced the Kiwis will be interested. They'd like to see the federal government do something more drastic, like ban New Zealand honey imports to force them to negotiate.
New Zealand's Manuka is from the same plant Australian Manuka's from and produced by the European honeybee, so honeybees can't tell a difference, nor can the consumer nine times out of 10, except with the label on the jar.
Dr. Peter Brooks from the University of the Sunshine Coast has researched the chemical properties of Manuka honey for a decade. He's supporting the Australian Producers Campaign and would like to see more politicians advocate for a truce in the trademark battle.
If we lose that name Manuka honey, we'll lose about 500 beekeepers, I reckon, which are small to medium businesses, family-owned businesses, that could go broke.
Dr. Peter Brooks from the Sunshine Coast University, ending that report from James Glenday. The federal opposition is pressing the government to offer visa extensions to Myanmar citizens living in Australia as violence in the country continues to escalate. Students from Myanmar, many of whom have criticised the military regime online, say it's simply not safe for them to return home. Here's Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts.
When the military seized power in Myanmar, Mary Ong was sitting in Australia, watching it unfold.
I was in shock. I couldn't believe it that it actually happened.
The international student was enraged by what she saw and has been a vocal online critic of the violent crackdown on protesters which followed.
Especially when I hear about children, people who are even younger than me, getting shot on the streets while protesting, just make my blood boil.
But now Mary, like many of the 3,500 or so Myanmar citizens currently living in Australia, doubts she can return safely.
As soon as I land in the country, I'll probably be arrested. So it's totally impossible. So I'm pretty sure there are also, you know, many students and people in the same boat as me. That's why, yeah, it'd be really great for Australia to take this action.
And the opposition is throwing its weight behind them. The Shadow Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, and Shadow Home Affairs Minister, Christina Keneally, have written to the government pressing it to grant visa extensions to Myanmar citizens. We are urging the government to enable Myanmar nationals on temporary visas in Australia to extend their stay, the letter reads. No one should be involuntarily deported to Myanmar. Meanwhile, some backbenchers on both sides of Parliament are becoming increasingly impatient with Australia's relatively cautious response to the coup.
What we're seeing here is a military regime digging in, and it cannot be legitimised.
Labour backbencher Peter Khalil is one of those who wants stronger action, and he's unhappy that so far all the government's done is suspend military cooperation with the regime.
I think the government makes snail pace look fast. This is Maurice MIA Payne on most foreign affairs issues.
He says the government should follow the UN and recognise civilian leaders of Myanmar as the legitimate government.
We should be recognising the legitimate democratically elected leaders of Myanmar, not an illegitimate, vicious military junta.
Labor's also pressing the government to hit members of the military regime with sanctions, while Mary Ong wants the government to target relatives of the junta living in Australia.
It's really unfair, given that people are dying in the streets. The culprits of the coup, those who are associated with them, are benefiting from the democracy in this country.
And as the death toll climbs in Myanmar, those calls will only grow.
That's Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts with that story. And a spokesperson for the Home Affairs Department says each case is assessed on its merits and visa decisions are not based on broad assumptions about the safety in particular countries. The high cost of caring for the elderly is often given as one of the reasons against lifting aged care standards in Australia. But now one of the peak bodies representing doctors claims billions of dollars are being wasted due to unnecessary hospital admissions of nursing home residents. In a report out today, the Australian Medical Association says the solution's pretty simple: more nurses and GPs working in aged care facilities. Nick Grimm reports.
With her husband severely incapacitated by a brain tumour and multiple strokes, this woman, who we'll call Rebecca, still feels traumatised by what he endured during his final days inside the aged care system.
The journey was very, very difficult. He needed very high care. The training of the care staff left a lot to be desired.
His complicated medical condition only made worse, Rebecca believes, by carers unable to understand his daily needs. And on one occasion, that resulted in her husband being sent to hospital when she felt it couldn't be justified.
The nurse absolutely insisted that he should be taken to hospital against my wishes. In my view, totally unnecessary. A lot of anxiety caused. Waste of ambulance time and patient transport.
They go off to hospital. They don't know what's going to be happening to them. It's awful, and it can be awful for the families too.
That's a carer who wants to be known as Jess. She's worked in the aged care system for 20 years. She also believes many staff are too quick to call an ambulance because they simply don't know what else to do.
Absolutely. But so many times, even though they go into hospital, it doesn't mean they're going to be cared for any better.
It's backed by modelling done for the Australian Medical Association, showing that close to 28,000 residents from nursing homes will be sent to hospitals unnecessarily this year at a cost of more than $300 million. AMA President Dr. Omar Khorshid.
They don't feel confident that they can care for people even with fairly basic needs, or people who are clearly at end of life and don't want to go to hospital, yet they get sent to hospital anyway. That is just not good enough, and we can do so much better than that by investing back into healthcare.
A view shared by Professor Kathy Eager, Director of the Australian Health Services Research Institute at the University of Wollongong.
A lot of people in hospitals don't need to be there, either because they had conditions that could have been prevented. And here I'm thinking about things like falls and medication errors and bed sores, or conditions that could have been really managed by the home if they had better staffing ratios.
Professor Kathy Eager, Director of the Australian Health Services Research Institute at the University of Wollongong, and Nick Grimm with that report. First Nations groups say it's a disgrace the Commonwealth hasn't delivered on a promise to see more Aboriginal Australians own water. 3 years ago, the federal government announced it would provide $40 million to First Nations to invest in water in the Murray-Darling Basin. But as National Rural Reporter Kath Sullivan found, it's still unclear how or when that money will be delivered.
My name, Brendan Kennedy. Enitai Wungi. I'm a river man from here, and I'm Tari Tari.
On the banks of the Mugoya Lagoon near Robinvale in Victoria's northwest, traditional owner Brendan Kennedy explains the connection that his people have with Australia's largest river system.
Because our people have been the owners of water, the stewards, the caretakers of water now for a millennium. They know what to do with their water, they know where water is needed.
Currently, less than 1% of water rights across the Murray-Darling Basin are owned by Aboriginal people.
The state of water ownership for traditional owners in the basin currently is absolutely disgraceful. It's deplorable. We're now, at the moment, it's 0.08%. You know, government should be ashamed of themselves.
In 2018, then Water Minister David Littleproud announced federal funding for First Nations to buy water after brokering a deal with the Labor Party.
We're announcing a $40 million fund that will allow them to economically participate in water to ensure that they not only get economic but also cultural outcomes.
Chair of the Northern Basin Aboriginal Nations, Fred Hooper, understood that water could be used for many reasons.
Water owned by us that we can use for spiritual, cultural, social, economic and environmental purposes, but we are the ones that that have control over that water and decide.
Fred Hooper says the First Nations groups he represents are still waiting. A statement from Water Minister Keith Pitt says the Aboriginal Water Entitlements Program needs to deliver real jobs and generate economic activity for Indigenous people. It says the minister shares frustration about the delays to the program and that he's committed to working with Indigenous organisations, but hasn't directly responded to the ABC's question about whether the money could be spent on non-water assets.
We're 3 years into the process now, and we need the minister to make a decision. We want to know what the minister's thinking. Originally, it was meant to buy water for First Nations within the Murray-Darling Basin.
$40 million won't buy a lot of water, about 6 gigalitres, according to Fred Hooper. But for Brendan Kennedy, the commitment to help traditional owners buy water could have an immeasurable impact across the almost 50 First Nations that exist basin-wide.
The suffering of our people relates directly back to the deprivation and the lack of recognition of First Nations people to own our water. They need to have their autonomy and their say, their decision-making around what's right for their water, for them and for their country.
That's traditional owner Brendan Kennedy, ending that report by Kath Sullivan. Prince Harry has arrived in the UK ahead of the Duke of Edinburgh's funeral on Saturday. He's issued a statement saying his fun-loving grandfather would want people to get on with their lives, despite a period of national mourning. As it happened, pubs in England have reopened following a long lockdown. And as Europe correspondent Nick Doll discovered, people didn't need much encouragement.
The streets of central London haven't been this lively in months. After some early snow, it turned into a beautiful spring day, just as pubs and restaurants were allowed to reopen, but only outdoors. AM came across Claire Jones and Judith Reese, who are enjoying an afternoon pint in the street in Soho.
Yeah, it's good. It's nice. It's we've taken the day off today. We're just enjoying the sunshine. And
it's been a pretty hard winter for everyone, hasn't it?
It's been really long, endless at times, but as it turns out, you know, it does end. And that's it.
Nearby, Josh Peacock was soaking up some sun with a friend. A sense of relief was written on their faces.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's been like the longest, darkest, coldest winter. Not many reasons to be optimistic. So, yeah, it's great to be having a pint with my mate. And, yeah, the sun's shining. What can you ask for?
The UK's meant to be in a period of national mourning following the death of the Duke of Edinburgh. But Josh doesn't think Prince Philip would mind people celebrating the end of lockdown.
He'd want us to go out, get a pint and enjoy ourselves. I'm sure that's what the Duke would want.
The Duke's grandson, Prince Harry, agrees. He's issued a statement paying tribute to his grandfather, calling him a master of the barbecue, a legend of banter, and cheeky right to the end. He says he can imagine the prince with a beer in hand telling everyone to just get on with it. In the street, AM happened across a man named Clive Room, who was dressed in a dark coat and a black tie, but he was having a beer as well.
Clive, how does it feel to be out and about?
Right now, it feels absolutely marvellous to be able to breathe filthy air surrounded by lots of other people and enjoy the pollution together. Cheers.
Technically speaking, we're in a period of mourning for the Duke, but...
Well, you'll notice I'm wearing a black tie.
Well,
for that precise reason, sir. I'll be in mourning until Saturday when he's buried.
What do you think he would think of people moping around on a lovely day like this?
He wouldn't consider this moping at all. This is quite productive. They've got off their backsides, they've gone out, they've done something. Even if that something is only to support British industry, like the brewers. Cheers.
Prince William has also issued a statement saying his grandfather was an extraordinary man who helped guide him through the good times and the bad. I will miss my grandpa, the Duke of Cambridge said, but I know he would want us to get on with the job. So, while the national mourning continues until the funeral on Saturday, life is finally returning to normal here. Those who knew the Duke best say he'd want people to go out and live it. This is Nick Doll in London reporting for AM.
That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Claudia Long.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. There's a loud question echoing in Australians' minds as the country has its belated Me Too moment. The big question is why? What drives this behaviour?
Today on The Signal, we speak to a criminologist who's followed the breadcrumbs back in an attempt to find out what fuels male sexual aggression. with the hope that the answer might bring us closer to a solution.
Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.